Welcome to Tampa Bay FM's Synergy Connection, where life as you currently live it can be transformed into the life you've always dreamed of. Understanding your synergistic connections is the pathway to your emotional, physical, spiritual, and mental wellness. Let's begin connecting the dots. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Synergy Connection Show. I have as my guest today Jim Lee, and Jim is a fourth generation Floridian. He was raised on a ranch as a child, and he was with the Tampa Tribune for 27 years. He's written for magazines like Florida Sportsman and Saltwater Sportsman, plus six other magazines during his lifetime. He's also spent much of his life outside in the woods and swamps of Florida. His first book was called Seafood Legends. And why don't we start this morning by having you talk a little bit about Seafood Legends before we begin discussing your newest book, Palmetto Sunrise.
Well, sure, Lucy. Thank you. When I fished a lot. I fished all the way around Florida out to New Orleans and East Coast and West Coast. And so I was writing for the newspapers, and I was writing for magazines, but I wasn't making any money. So I thought, well, why don't I write a book? So I did. I wrote a book with seafood recipes in it. Most of them are mine, new. They're original. And each recipe has a story germane to it. And the recipes are good, but the stories are even better.
So maybe give an example of one of those recipes and the story that went with it.
Oh, dear. From memory?
From memory.
How about
the one about the crocodile? Or was it an alligator?
No, I don't want to use that one.
Okay.
But I'll tell you what I will use. I was out fishing with a guy in a big boat. And it was about a 34-footer and with a fly bridge. And we were shark fishing, so we were chumming, and up comes this shark, and so, you know, he came to the, and the boat was running, and so the propeller was removing because we had just moved. Well, he came up, and the shark attacked the boat. First, he ran into the boat, and then he went around the back, and he attacked the prop because it was moving and shiny.
Oh, and he thought it was a fish.
And he ate it, and it killed him.
Oh my gosh.
We thought, well, boy, we better move, because this is a bad spot now, kind of. So we moved. And the other guy's up on the bridge, and he says, oh, my God, here comes another shark. And about that time, I fell in. I was reaching over with chumming. Yeah, I fell in. Well, remembering the last one, it was so traumatic that I clawed my way back into the boat. And then I saw it, and then he says, oh, it's not a shark after all. So I grabbed the gaff, okay, and we got a gaff that's about 8 foot long. And I grabbed the gaff, and I reached over, and this is a cobia, which looks like a shark.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
I gaffed him. Well, this is a big cobia. And so the two of us are wrestling this thing, and the fish is beating us to death with the end of that of the gaff. We finally got it into the boat, and so as a result, I ended up giving the fish to the captain, but I made a recipe out of it, and I took a piece of it home, and it was using vermouth, and I don't remember the exact recipe, but it was a vermouth recipe for that fish. And it turned out pretty good, actually. Really good.
Well, I know that I have my own personal copy, and I have used recipes from it, and all of the recipes are excellent. Where can people find that particular book, the Seafood Legend book, if they want to have some great fish recipes and stories?
Well, they can go to the same place for both books. It's jimleeauthor.com. That's my website. And that'll take you to Amazon, where you can download the book either in Kindle or the book itself.
Or the book itself, okay. And if they happen to run into you someplace, they can buy it directly from you if True. You're at a book signing.
True. And I sell it a little bit less because I take care of the freight and the tax.
Okay. All right. That sounds really good. Well, we're going to start this interview by talking about how you decided to even write a book. How do you write a book so that a publisher might be interested in actually taking you on and promoting your book and all of those things that go into book writing?
Right. Well, in the first place, to get to a publisher is almost impossible. The only way you do that generally is a smaller publishing house, okay? And you've got to look around and find them. Because the old-fashioned way is you find an agent and they find a publisher, and you may make a buck or two out of that. Now, the newfangled way of publishing a book these days is to self-publish it and hire everything else done. And, you know, you find your own editor and you find your own marketing person. And that's what everybody's doing now. Okay. And in order to make a book that someone would be interested in, there's a lot that goes on. Number one, you got to study writing. You got to take a course. You need to subscribe to the writer's magazines. You need to outline the book by chapter, and or freestyle it. But I freestyle each chapter. And in effect, the book writes itself, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I do have an outline for every chapter, which may change. But, you know, and so you then after you get that done, you write, you rewrite. And then you hire an editor, okay?
And then the editor rewrites and rewrites.
yeah, but not your mother or not your husband or not your wife, because mm-hmm. you need a professional editor, okay?
Right.
Because they not only edit what you misspell, but they edit the structure.
The structure of it itself,
And so once you do all that, you may find somebody interested. Now, I was lucky. I was introduced by Lucy to a small publishing house. And when I went to the interview or to meet her, I just happened to take a synopsis of the book with me. Mm-hmm. And she liked it. And so she took it on.
So it's kind of like being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. Yeah, right. Or who you know. It's who you know.
With your style of writing, it's unique. There aren't that many books that I've ever read, and I know I was helpful in the beginning to read and reread and reread some of yours.
Yeah. She was my principal editor at first.
But the way you write is not only entertaining, but it's very descriptive. So the thing that I noticed almost immediately is I was transported into old Florida, and I could feel me there, you know, walking through the swamps or walking the trails. And I don't think you find that often, where a writer kind of transports you into some part of history. So with Palmetto Sunrise, what inspired you to write it to begin with?
Well, two or three things. Number one, Florida history regarding the Florida cracker, which I'll explain that. Florida cracker is a cowboy that uses a cow whip to drive cows with.
So the cracking sound.
The cracking sound of the whip. That's where that came from originally. Mm-hmm. And it's been convoluted from that, but that's what it means. And a lot of history in that direction has been lost. Now, there is another good book out there, Land Remembered, A Land Remembered. Mm-hmm. And I read that book after I was about almost through with mine. And it's a good book, too. But actually, not only for that reason, but my grandfather and my son. Because my grandfather wanted to write a book about his early days so bad, and he took a lot of notes. And he did, there must have been 50 or 80 pages of notes about his early days and what he did and all the anecdotes in there. And when he died, I got those notes.
So now, he didn't do anything with them while he was
alive?
No,
he didn't.
He just wrote?
But he told me he'd leave him with me, and then he died up in Georgia, and I had to fight his wife's family up there to get him, but I did get him. And
they wanted to keep them?
Well, I'm not sure what there was going on there, but anyway, mm-hmm. they finally sent him to me.
Okay.
And so, then there's my son. You see, I want my son to know his heritage and what's behind before him, you know. Uh-huh. And so for those two, three reasons, I decided that it would be a good book. And Palmetto Sunrise was one of my very first choices for a title.
So what does that title actually mean, Palmetto Sunrise?
The Rise of Florida.
The Rise of Florida. But yeah. Palmettos are...
Or Florida.
But it's a palm, isn't it?
It's a bush.
Palm. A bush,
It's a palmy bush, yeah.
Yeah, and it's all over the whole state.
All over the whole state, yeah.
And I think I recall that it's very sharp. So if you walk up by one, you can slice yourself.
No, they're not sharp. There is a breed that does have spines on the stem, but mm-hmm. no, generally they're not. Huh?
Okay.
They're not.
And
but they're thick everywhere, and they're hard to walk through, and some of them are huge.
Oh.
But think about this, the sunrise coming up over a patch of palmettos. And that's what happened when the first governor of Florida, which was Penelurus Argus. I'm not getting the name right. But anyway, when he landed on Florida, the sun was coming up and you could see the sun over the palmettos. And that's what gave me the idea. And then I think, well, that represents Florida growing up. And this is back history of Florida before it was like it is now.
How many people do you think are still living that saw Florida in its early stages? Not in the very, very beginning, but let's...
Well, I mean, I'm 82, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember what it was like when I was growing up in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And
a lot of dirt roads.
A lot of dirt roads, yeah, a lot of dirt roads. As a matter of fact, when we bought a house in Orlando, we lived on a dirt road.
And that was in Orlando.
That was in Orlando, yeah. So,
have you ever gone back to find that dirt road?
Oh, yeah. Well, I inherited the house, and I rented it for several years, and then I sold it. But it's not dirt anymore.
Is it concrete or blacktop?
Blacktop.
Blacktop, okay. So you wanted to write it to share with your son and to help your grandfather's memories come alive.
Exactly, because he and I were very close. We used to hunt together in the Everglades, and I have nothing but good feelings about my grandfather.
Mm. I'm going to suggest a story here that I remember you and I talking about, but I think you were in the Everglades and you got lost.
Oh, yeah.
Grandfather.
Yeah,
he and I. So why don't you tell that story?
Yeah, he and I got lost in the glades. We were down there hunting, and it got in afternoon, 2 or 3 o'clock, and we didn't know how to get out of where we were. It was so thick.
Mm.
And so we were in almost chest-deep water and in a swamp. And so I decided to climb a tree and see if I could see where they got thinner. And I could. I saw where they got thinner, and we headed that way. And we walked through that, and we got out of the swamp, but we were still lost. And so night came, and this is what we had with us. We had our guns. We had a sack with our raincoat in it, a half a sandwich, and some water. I had a canteen, and so did he. And so we found high ground, which was about 3 inches above the water.
That's
in
high.
The glades. That's high ground. And my grandfather put down a bunch of palmetto fans for us to lay down on and built a fire. And we put our feet to the fire and our raincoats on, and we spent the night there.
And you weren't worried about snakes or other animals that might come?
Not with the fire going, no. Mm. Nowadays, I couldn't do that because there's pythons and boa constrictors, all kinds of big snakes.
Yeah, the anacondas are down there.
Anacondas, yeah. I don't know.
And they take care of deer, so you would be an appetizer.
Absolutely. But what's really interesting on that trip, when we were going to getting out, we found this area that had yellow vines all over the grass, and it was like walking in a net, and it was very hard to walk in it, and it took us a long time to get out of that. And once we did, we got back to our camp, which was an old sawmill, And I went to wash my boots off in the canal and dropped one of them overboard. And so I took off my clothes. It was in winter, too. I took off my clothes, and I jumped in. And just as I went to grab it, it fell through the grass, and you couldn't see it. So I came out, and my grandfather had another pair of boots, brogans, you know, high-top shoes. And so I had one brogan and one tennis shoe. And walking through the glades like that, it's like rock with marl or kind of a mud over it. And then there was all these ground rattlers, which are about, up to a foot long. And you just mash them in the mud as you go along.
With a tennis shoe?
With a tennis shoe.
They could bite right through.
No, they're little. Their heads are about as big as your thumb.
Oh, my goodness.
So.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, that was an experience.
So I guess my next question would be, how did you find so much information on Florida history? I know that your grandfather left you a lot, but then you probably had to supplement some of that with just understanding Florida, you know, as it used to be.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I grew up hunting and fishing and deep in the swamps and rivers of Florida.
Uh-huh.
And at one point, I was a successful photographer of Florida scenics and wildlife, including, and I used to do paintings too. And some of my photographs still hang in the law offices and doctor's office down in South Florida because I had 2 one-man shows down there.
Mm-hmm.
And but I loved to go in the middle of a swamp, especially in the spring, because the air plants bloom and they're beautiful.
Oh.
And there's all kind of opportunities for photographs out there in the wild.
So do you still do photography when you can now?
Yeah, I don't do it as often as I used to. I used to never go anywhere without my cameras.
Mm-hmm.
But it was film cameras back then. And
right.
Now I'm into digital, and I've got some really good wildlife pictures. And what I did, I knew I needed an agent to
mm-hmm.
sell my pictures. So mm-hmm. I went to Florida Writers Convention, which also had photograph agents there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wangled my way in a seat next to this agent lady. And we got to talking, and she says, okay, we'll do something. And so I had about 8 pictures that I thought were worthy. And she says, I said, okay, I've got about 8 pictures. She says, well, I'm going to need about 25. So I had to get busy. I had to get out in the woods and do more,
mm-hmm.
which I managed to do. And she's the one that set up the one-man shows down in South Florida in the financial district. And that was a fun time. But the hurricane came along, blew her house away, and so they moved to Chicago. And you can't take pictures, print pictures, and sell pictures as a one-man. It's hard.
Right.
So I just kind of, also, in all honesty, my attention span is not that long on whatever I'm doing. You know, I'll shift from one to the other. When I got back from Japan in the Army, I started painting. And I painted for a couple of years. And one of my friends kept stealing my paintings because he liked them.
Which meant you had to paint another one.
Yeah. So finally I painted one for him. He's got one of my barracudas hanging in his garage right now.
Doesn't yeah. seem to be an appropriate place.
Used to be in his bathroom. So
oh, okay.
Elevator.
So it kind of moved from the bathroom to the garage. I always think of Clyde Butcher.
He's good.
He's amazing. I went down to years ago now, but Clyde Butcher had a show with Ansel Adams.
Ooh.
And it was at the Ringling School of, or his museum there.
Uh-huh.
And gosh, this has been maybe 14 years ago mm-hmm. now, something mm-hmm. like that. But, you know, he does the big formats.
Yeah, right.
And you walked in, and if you went to the left, it was Ansel Adams.
Mm-hmm.
If you went to the right, it was Clyde Butcher.
Wow.
But it was the most amazing show. And, you know, Clyde had a heart attack
mm-hmm.
Not very long ago. And he's recovered, and there's a place in Sarasota that is his gallery. And it's just the Clyde Butcher, and that's all that's down there. But, you know, just amazing pictures
wow.
of trees and orchids and the swamps and sunlight coming through the palm trees.
Well, in one room of my house, I have a black and white wall
mm-hmm.
Of stuff that I've done and an Ansel Adams that my wife had given me. mm-hmm. many years ago before we were married. And so I've got black and white all on one wall, and then on another wall I've got three paintings, one of the by the highwaymen. Mm. And they used to run up and down US-1 and paint and sell their pictures door to door.
Right.
And but now their paintings are quite expensive.
Yes, they are.
And I've got two of mine up there too. And and my favorite that I got hanging on my wall is this chicken or this rooster with sunglasses on. It was a greeting card a friend of mine sent to me, and I just framed it because it was so funny.
Oh my goodness! Well, all right. Let's have you read a little bit from Palmetto Sunrise so that people will get a flavor of what this book is really all about.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start with the first chapter, which is actually called The Old Hotel, and it's actually the prelude, or what do you call that?
Prologue.
Prologue. Yeah, that's close. It was November 25th, 1984. James Brian Lee was quail hunting with his dad, James, which is me. They were a few miles south of U.S. Highway 60, just below River Ranch, Florida, and they stopped their four-wheel drive Scout 2 beside the winding banks of the Kissimmee River, got out, and started walking. Ahead, Brian could see the ruins of an old building's foundation. Approaching the ruins, James stopped, squatted down, and removed his old Stetson hat. It was the last hat his grandfather, James A. O'Berry, had given him before he died 10 years prior. James, a fourth-generation Floridian, rested his shotgun on one leg and gazed out over the river covered in dark green hyacinths and bordered with gray-green cypress trees. In his mind's eye, James could see the old paddle-wheel, flat-bottomed ferry boat beached at an angle, with the bow resting on a sandy bank, the gangplank slanting down to the shore, just like his grandfather had described it to him. He could imagine the passengers as they walked down the gangplank carrying the bags and bundles towards a two-story, five-room hotel. The hotel was run by Jim and Elizabeth, Brian Lee's great-grandfather and great-grandmother. The small hotel was an overnight stop for the crew and passengers of the stern-driven wood-fire paddle-wheel ferry boat. The passengers were headed downriver to the Great Lake Okeechobee and Okeechobee City. This was their overnight stop in the middle of nowhere during those adventurous bygone days. "What's up, Dad?" Brian asked as he carefully leaned his shotgun against the foundation as a buzzard circled lazily overhead in the clear blue sky. Brian was 14 years old, dressed in jeans, snake boots, a camouflage jacket, and an old army boonie hat. He moved quickly and was a typical 14-year-old who enjoyed the outdoors. "I was just daydreaming about your great-grandfather and grandmother, son." "Why were you thinking about them, Dad?" Brian asked. "I suppose because we're standing on hallowed ground, son." "What do you mean?" "This place was once a hotel, run by your great-grandfather and grandmother." "You're kidding," Brian exclaimed. "Nope. I'm sure this is the very place where some of the best meals were dished out to travelers who came down river on the ferry boat. Granddaddy O'Berry hunted deer and turkeys and raised pigs and chickens for meat. Grandmother would cook the meals for the travelers with the meats he butchered and vegetables they grew. But there was nothing like Grandma O'Berry's black-eyed peas with a ham bone in the pot, or a piece of venison backstrap wrapped in bacon and cooked in butter. Once in a while, the captain of the ferry boat would bring them some ice, and grandmother would get out the old hand-crank ice cream churn, and they'd have ice cream for dessert. They charged 50 cents for a meal and 50 cents for a cot to sleep on. That was darn expensive in those days, too, so they were doing pretty well back then." "How long did they do this, Dad?" "They worked the hotel for about 3 years. Then a drought set in and dried up the river. So Jim and Lizzie had to move on. This place, son, is a piece of history, a part of your ancestry."
Okay, so definitely you could kind of feel that Brian, at that point, was curious. He didn't understand that he was on hallowed grounds. And I think he began to appreciate or see this Florida history through different eyes.
Yeah, yeah. And not being a reader, it took him a while to read the book.
Didn't you tell me that he has like dyslexia, so it's very difficult?
No, not dyslexia. No, he had trouble assimilating what he heard. And it was a defect that he overcame. And it took him an extra couple of years to get out of college, but he graduated because he perseveres. He pursues it. He doesn't stop.
Uh-huh.
And as a result, he was able to retire at age 49 with money in the bank. And they're now getting ready to travel the United States pulling a fifth-wheel trailer.
Mm-hmm. I know he ended up with this humongous truck that he can pull it with.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a Ford F-250.
So when a person, you know, gets Palmetto Sunrise and decides to read it, I think they're going to feel that you are transported back to old Florida. So how did you go about gaining that perspective where you could tell the story, you know, like a storyteller, you know, instead of just a writer that's putting down words on paper? I think it comes across as somebody who is taking on the role of the historian telling the story.
Well, I learned a great deal as a boy. I grew up in the 1940s in this area, mm-hmm. in Kissimmee, in the backwoods and whatnot, with three other boys, and which is probably going to be my next book, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned about the Miccosukee Indians. And
who were they? How do you say that?
The Miccosukees, okay. Yeah, they're one of the many tribes that became Seminoles.
So they became Seminoles, but initially they had their own name.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were transported here by the army and they, you know, against their will.
Oh, okay.
And so they took up in South Florida. And by the way, the Seminoles never surrendered.
Hmm.
And so now they run the casinos and the...
I think they're doing okay.
I think they're doing fine now, yeah. I lived in old Florida. It's part of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And with the outhouses and the turkey hunts. And I never will forget my first turkey hunt. I couldn't have been more than 12. I think I was younger than that. And my step-grandpa... house. He had this huge four-poster bed, mm-hmm. and he, I was asleep, feather mattress, and I laid down to go to sleep, and I couldn't go to sleep because all I could think about was turkey hunting the next day. And as boys, we did that. We would rabbit hunt at night, and I got to tell you this one thing. Five of us were out rabbit hunting one night. Okay, we had a bag of rabbits, so it was a croaker bag full of rabbits. And this one guy would sell them. And we'd all take one home to eat, and then he'd sell the rest. Well, the skunk came out from under the fence. And everybody started to shoot.
Oh.
And I said, no. Well, everybody
shot. It's too late.
And they shot. And so he ran back under the fence. I don't even think they killed him. And as we got near the fence, we hit this wall of skunk.
Yeah.
My grandmother made me take my clothes off on the back porch. And then she scrubbed me down.
What, is it true that the only thing that really gets off skunk smell is tomato juice?
Well, that's one of the things, I guess. I don't think she used that on me, but it was not fun to be getting scrubbed with a brush, I tell you that.
Oh, jeez. So you, by living in old Florida, then a lot of what you write about are memories.
Exactly. That combined with what my grandfather left me, all of his papers and things,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that I, you know, I grew up on a cattle ranch, really, and we would have roundups, and
mm-hmm.
I was a leg man, I was a front leg man. The leg man was the guy in the back. He grabs a hind leg, and the guy in the front reaches over. The calf, grabs his leg, pulls him up, which puts him on the ground, and then the other leg man puts his leg up against the cow and holding his leg. That way you can mark and brand him.
Huh.
And so I did that as a kid. And we'd have dinner on the ground after the, you know, after the roundup. The women would bring food. And I never will forget, my grandpa had bought this horse. And the horse was the ugliest horse I ever saw in my life.
I didn't think you could have an ugly horse.
This horse's head was out of proportion.
Oh, okay. So.
And so, but anyway, this horse was unbroken. So I'm thinking, I'm living there for the summer, right? I'm thinking, I'm going to break this horse. So every time I'd walk by his stall, I had a straw hat. He tried to take it off my head. But anyway, what I did, I got him used to a bridle, first of all, without the bit in the mouth, and then with a bit. And then I'd lead him around, and he was good for that. And then I put a pad on his back, and then I went and rode him around. And then a week or so later, I'd put the saddle up there. And so then come the day, and I'm out by myself. Nobody knows I'm out there, okay, behind the house. And I decided to get on this horse. And so I got on the horse, and the horse was fine. He just stood there. And I walked him around the lot where I was at, and he was fine. And so I did that several days, and then we were going to have a roundup. And I asked my grandpa, I said, you know that I've got the horse. I can ride the horse. Can I take him to the roundup? He says, sure. So the only thing wrong with the horse, that he wasn't bridle-wise. And in order to get him turned right, I have to smack him on the head with my left hand.
Oh.
And vice versa. Well, to make a long story short, they missed a bunch of cows. And I had to go back to the house to get something. And I came back. It was probably about 2 miles to the pens. And I came back and I found a small, you know, like 8 or 10 cattle that I thought I would try and run back to where we were at, you know. Well, I ran the horse in the ground. It was the only time my grandfather ever said a discouraging word to me. Because the horse was out of breath and panting. And the trouble is, if you overwork a horse, they'll get the staggers and they'll die. And so you got to be careful about that. And all these cowboy movies you see where they ride and run, well, that's for 30 seconds or a minute. You know, they
no,
don't do
it's,
that.
It's not and, indefinitely. And
you can lope for a little ways
mm-hmm.
at a steady, you know, it's not a trot, but it's the next thing up. But to run them, you can't.
Mm-hmm. Remember the movie Hidalgo?
Oh, yeah.
So that would have not been accurate, maybe?
Well, now, that horse was used to long excursions, but most of those guys, they didn't run their horse.
Mm-hmm.
They walked them, you know. They'd run a while, walk a while, run a while, walk a while. Because horses just can't stand up to that much.
Right. I mean, even with the derbies and on all of the horse racing, it's a shorter,
yep.
a mile.
That's right.
You know, a mile
that's
and
right.
a half, and then that's it.
Yep, that's yeah. right.
I know that they can get basically kind of like human beings, shin splints.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by running them too much.
Mm-hmm.
Because their bones will just break.
Right.
Well, as you began your book, the history of early Florida is told through your great-grandfather when he was, what, about 17?
Yeah.
Okay. And did you, as you were beginning to put the chapters together and to kind of feel your way along, did you know how the book was going to actually unfold? Did you have that sense of, this is my beginning and this will be the middle and this will be the end?
No, well, in a way, yes and no. All right, I outlined the book.
Mm-hmm.
I outlined each chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said before, each chapter kind of writes itself. But and it changed, things change as you go along,
mm-hmm.
right? And no, the ending was never known.
Until you got there.
Until I got there.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, there it was.
Right.
Which, by the way, the endings of a book are one of the most important parts of the book.
Right.
Because it leaves you with the feeling of the whole book, or should.
Mm-hmm.
And so my ending answered a lot of questions tried to actually end the book like you would think it would end.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'm thinking of J.K. Rowling's with all the Harry Potter books that she wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that your book that you're thinking about writing with the three boys
mm-hmm.
is kind of an extension, in a way, of this book.
Because, exactly.
So you, in a way, if you're writing a book that has sequels,
mm-hmm.
you want to leave that possibility, too.
That yep.
this is the conclusion of this part of the story, but the next part of the story may come out of it.
Well, actually, in this one, we'll go back further, because this one ends, in early 1900s, 1930s probably, I would think. But my new book is going to end in the 1940s, because it'll begin and end in 1940, 41, long in there.
Okay.
And as
before the war.
Yeah, before the war. And maybe right after it broke out.
That would be an interesting feature if it did, you know, right after it broke out, because I'm sure that there were a lot of young men that were excited, actually,
well,
about going to war.
My two cousins, one of them, they both went in the Air Force, and one of them flew P-38s in the Pacific, and one of them threw DC-3 over the hump in Asia, and so they all came back, luckily, in one piece. And my cousin had this one problem. There was a whole bunch of them had a mission to go on, and he had to turn around because one engine started cutting out on him. So he had to find a place to land, and or if it cut off too much, he'd end up in the drink, you know. So he saw this Japanese island, and he thought, well, there's a beach. But then ahead of him, he saw a landing strip. And there was a lot of small landing strips around. And the Japanese, he didn't know if they were there or not. But he landed his P-38. He got out, and he cleaned out the fuel line, and he got it cranked again, and got it out of there and went back to his base. But that was an exciting time for him, I can guarantee you.
I would think so. They just had, I think it was on the news last night on ABC, a 100-year-old World War II veteran.
Right, I saw it.
And I thought that was so interesting because they had other veterans that are more modern day from the Iraq War and Afghanistan and stuff right now. And they were all, you know, paying a tribute, basically, to him. But that was beautiful.
You know, they call the First World War the Great War. But actually, the Second World War, to me, was the Great War. Because there were more people involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So there are three characters that travel together during a portion of the story. And how did they know each other? You know, how did you put them in there?
Well, it begins with my great-grandfather, okay? And one day this girl bumped into him on purpose.
On purpose?
She wanted to meet him. And they ended up getting married.
Okay.
There's a scene at the flowing well where he had fish. He ran fish traps, and that's how he made extra money. He was a very industrious person, and so he took her out there. She went with him to bring in the fish traps, you know, and they waded out in the creek and brought them in and put them in boxes, and because he sold them to a local restaurant that sold his sold fish meal there. And so they got together, and at that point in time, they realized that they were meant for each other. And so then they got married a month later.
Wow, that's fast.
Yeah, well, back then, things happened pretty fast, you know. And at a younger age, because she was only 14 and he was 17.
Oh, my goodness. She was only 14 years old? My goodness.
And they married young back then, you know. And so then they had this little house. And he also had a friend called Wolf Johnson, and Jeremiah Wolf Johnson. And Wolf Johnson had a reputation for jumping off his horse and bulldogging wild steers, wild cattle, okay, just for fun.
Wow.
And he also had a reputation for running down wolves, because there was a lot of wolves in Florida back then, and shooting them with his handgun, getting up to it and close enough to him to shoot him with his handgun. And so that's why he was called Wolf Johnson. His real name was Jeremiah, I think. But and he was a friend of my great-grandfather. And so they all decided, the three of them, that they were going to migrate from Alligator Town, where they lived, which turned out later in later years to become Lake City, down to the Kissimmee River Valley. And so they went by ox cart, and they had two oxen. One was Lightning, and the other one was called Speedy Boy. And of course, oxen aren't very fast, you know.
I wouldn't think so.
But, yeah, those are different times.
So then they were able to, I mean, obviously they spent a fair amount of time together.
And they went into business together, actually, and they were ranch. It was his ranch because he had the money, but Wolf Johnson was top dog, you know. He was like a partner, and all through the time that they were alive, you know. And,
are those three of the guys, I remember when I was helping you do the initial editing, are those three of the guys that went into tomato farming too, or is that?
Yeah, that was my grandfather.
Okay.
My grandfather and his sidekick, which is another story. Yeah. Well, the book progresses as my grandfather grows up, see, and then it shifts to him and how he wanted to go to grow tomatoes over on Andros Island in the Bahamas. And they actually did try to do this, and they got over there and got lost and came back. But the story is a lot more exciting than that.
Right, right. So we have a combination, I think, mostly nonfiction in your story. But I know you wove some fiction in it from time to time.
Well, here's the thing. All of the major events in this book happened. Mm-hmm. How they happened and who was there and what was said and what was done is a little different. That's where the fiction comes in.
Okay.
Because, you know, they would drive cattle from Kissimmee over to Tampa and also down further down south. Cattle would go to get on a boat and they'd take them to Cuba. Because after the Spanish-American War, they had no cattle down there. And so that was a great market. And the Cuban buyers would come up with saddlebags full of gold to buy the cattle. And they'd buy 1,500 head at a time. And so they would drive them over there. And what happened, you know, there was thieves, there was cattle rustlers and whatnot all along the way.
Uh-huh.
And so, because it was a rough time back then. And the book brings all that out.
Oh, okay. Well, let's have you read another short excerpt from the book. And before you start that, tell people where they can actually find this book again.
Okay, just go to jimleeauthor.com. That's JimLeeAuthor. Just like it sounds, jimleeauthor.com. You can go, and that'll take you to my website for both the books. And and it'll also take you right to Amazon, where you can download them or buy the book.
Okay, so let's hear another little short excerpt so people will understand what it is they're going to be reading about.
Okay. Frank and Martha Obery, along with their friend Joshua Wolf Johnson, were migrating to Central Florida to start a ranch. They planned to round up wild cattle that roamed the woods, which were originally brought over by the Spanish. Frank pulled their swaying wagon up beside Wolf's horse. In the stillness, Wolf Johnson's saddle creaked as he turned to ask, "You want me to scout ahead and see how deep it gets and see if there are any big gators or anything else to worry about on the other side?" "I reckon that might be a wise move." Wolf moved off to the gloom of the swamp and came back a half hour later. "Well, Mr. Johnson, why are you frowning?" Martha asked. It looked peaceful enough at first glance on the other side, but I did notice some horse tracks, but they were old. Both dogs, Matilda and Blue, took off in the woods. "Best call the dogs. Don't want to lose them to gators," Frank said. "Gators," exclaimed Martha. "Why would a self-respecting gator have the likes of old Blue, or Matilda for that matter, to even to chew on?" "Now, Martha, old Blue might hear you and think that you don't love him anymore." "But you're most likely right. Those gators might be the ones in trouble." "Blue," Frank called sharply, and there was a distant rustling in the palmettos, which grew closer, and finally Blue appeared, wet, muddy, and panting, but have the distinct look of a canine accomplishment. "We better put the dogs in the wagon," Frank said. "Up, boy." Frank called and slapped the seat, and Blue leaped in and took his position between Martha and Frank. "Where did Matilda go?" "He'll be along directly when he hears me in the water." "Matilda," Wolf shouted, and he whistled as he headed off into the swamp. The gray trunks of the cypress trees were thick at the bottom and then slimmed up to the thin, pale green leaves of the overhead branches, where they almost covered the trail like a canopy. Making it even darker, Wolf was gone for about 45 minutes. "It looks as if the trail through this cypress stand is just about wide enough for the wagon and not too deep, folks," Wolf recommended. "It's also clear enough to see well out into the swamp on both sides. That'll help us keep a lookout for varmints, so I'll lead out." Matilda came whomping up through the reddish-black swamp water until it got too deep and then paddled himself up behind Wolf's horse that was already belly-deep. "Wolf, there's a good-sized gator moving up behind Matilda." "Here, boy," Wolf called. "Come on, Matilda," Wolf yelled as he turned in the saddle, jerking his cowhip off the saddle tie. He let out about 6 feet of it and smacked the handle down on the top of the gator's head. The gator snapped at the handle but missed and sank into the murky water. Wolf grabbed Matilda by the nape of the neck and dragged him across the saddle in front of him. Now, old Blue had never been known to miss out on a good fight. The gator reappeared, and Blue leaped, sailing through the air
right at the gator. "Blue!" Frank bellowed. But the dog hit the water with a huge splash, bobbed to the surface, and began swimming towards a confused reptile as it submerged again. "Look out, Frank. I think the gator's going after Blue," Martha shouted. They saw the gator come back up off to one side of the dog. Blue, unable to find the gator, had turned around and was swimming back to the wagon. It was apparent that the alligator would get the dog before he reached the wagon. Frank, sitting in a crouched position on the wagon, sprang off the wagon straight at the gator. As he hit the dark water, his huge hands grappled for the gator's snout. They thrashed in the waist-deep water for a few tense moments before both man and beast went under the murky depths. The splashing and hollering by Wolf and Martha and Matilda's barking created a total chaotic scene. Martha pulled out her 25-20 lever-action rifle from under the cowhide cover and levered the shell in the chamber as she stood up. Frank surfaced, standing red-faced and with a 6-foot gator under one arm, and the other arm held his snout shut. The gator thrashed wildly and his tail splashing the swamp water all over Wolf and his horse. That spooked Wolf's horse, who reared up, nearly putting Wolf and Matilda in the water, with Wolf hollering, "Hold him, Frank, hold him. What in tarnation you think I'm trying to do? What I want to know is, how do I let this dang thing go?" Blue jumped off the wagon again to get back into the fray and grabbed the gator back by the back leg. "Blue's got him by the foot, Frank. You're safe now," Wolf howled and began to laugh. "Funniest thing ever seen, Frank. You're trying to skin a live gator while a dog is trying to take it away from you. Ooh-wee, what a sight. Eat him up, Blue," Frank growled. "Get back, Blue."
You can almost imagine the fray that would have been, with people going lots of different directions.
Oh, yeah.
So I know that his wife was a good shot, right?
Oh, very.
Yeah, I remember that part of the story, that he was impressed with her ability shoot. Wow.
Well, there was one in there where they're in their first house, you know, before they migrated. And she looked out across the potato field and saw a buck deer standing over there in the morning light.
Mm.
And he said, "Frank, look over there." And Frank did and says, "Hand me my rifle, if you would." She did. She says, You sure you don't want me to shoot it? That's a 200-yard shot. He says, "I'll manage."
And he got it.
What was really funny, though, then after he shot the deer, he says, "Well, I did my job. I shot it. Won't you go fetch it?" And she says, "He who shoots it, fetches it, and cleans it."
So in that case...
She called him Joker Man.
Joker Man, yeah. I was going to say, in that case, then it probably would have been better if he'd let her shoot it. Because then she would have done the rest. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's fun to write, I got to tell you.
Mm. Was there a reason that the prologue for the book was done the way you did it? So it kind of sets the story up in advance, and that doesn't happen very often, so I was curious about that.
Well, there's several reasons for that, actually. Number one, the prologue, if you think about it, is actually the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Extended.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are the downstream relatives, you know, me and my son.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And so...
Future generations.
Future generations, yeah. And so I did it that way because it ties in the hotel into the story
mm-hmm.
right up front
mm-hmm.
and gives you something to think about. And that's coming, you know.
Right.
But that was most of the reason I did that. And,
yeah.
Of course, the book, although it was dedicated to my grandfather, it was really written for my son. And
so that he has a sense of his heritage.
Yes, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on a visual level, it's almost like you're looking ahead, because a lot of times books are written where you're looking back.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, you're ahead of the game looking back.
Right, right.
So it's a little bit...
It wasn't a flashback, it was a flash forward.
A flash forward, right. Yeah, because they're there looking.
And I got to tell you, I wondered about that, so I asked my publisher about it, and she agreed it was good.
Yeah, I think so. You've gone to Brooker Creek.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so over at Brooker Creek, for those listening that are in the Pinellas County area, we have a place that is, I don't know how many acres are over there with
Big.
It's huge. And I know they have Florida panthers and things that are in there and some bobcats. They have markings, for them. But at any rate, there is a little movie. And I don't think you've ever seen it. And I've always tried to get you and your wife over there. But the movie is a flashback on what Brooker Creek
used to be.
And the way they do it is absolutely amazing, because you're sitting on little benches and it's like the characters are walking right towards you the way they have the movie done. It's not on a flat screen. And so the young lady is talking to her realtor. And the realtor is going to, you know, sell this property to turn it into homes and condos and whatnot. And so the history is being told as to what they're going to lose if they do that.
Right.
And by the end of this little movie, she's made the decision that she's going to hang on to it so that it will represent a part of old Florida.
She's got my own heart.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted you to see it, because it's beautifully told, and of course that is exactly what they've done with Brooker Creek. It will be in perpetuity for everyone who lives, you know, in Pinellas County or is visiting Pinellas County and would find out about it, because it's quite an amazing place there. Do you have some advice for people that, you know, at this point, maybe they're listening and they're going, well, you know, I have some really neat stories to tell. Or maybe I wrote a book, it's called The Adventures of Miss Twiggs and Company. And, you know, there may be writers like myself that are looking at writing something that will make a difference in somebody's life, you know, just because they've, have a story that they want to tell, or they have a value maybe that they want to bring to others. So, you know, how do you find the right publisher? And how are books even marketed today?
Well, not like they used to be.
Right.
You know, in the old days, you found or you researched and you found an agent to take you on.
Mm-hmm.
And then the agent would go and get the publisher to take it on.
Right.
Okay.
Are there really that many agents even out there anymore?
Oh, there's a ton of them.
Are there? Okay.
Matter of fact, for this book, I had about 6 or 8 of them lined up that did that kind of book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's the way I was going to go until I was fortunate enough to meet a small publisher and to get the book out there. And
because otherwise you end up with just a very small percentage of the sales, as I recall.
That's true. That's true. And in my case, I got a larger hunk because I paid up front.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I paid for the cover, I paid for the editing, and I paid for the organization of the book and the printing of the book.
Right.
Not the printing, excuse me. The first three, though. And that's the way it's happened these days is that you do the book yourself. You do a self published book.
Uh-huh.
Well, first of all, your book has to be right. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So you need to know the rules.
And so, how do you go about learning the rules?
Read books, buy books, read books. I belong to the Florida Writers Association, Florida Outdoor Writers Association. I got a magazine on writing that I take. And then I Google, because I was already through with my book when I learned a lot of the big things that I didn't know. And for example, the ending that I mentioned earlier, I didn't realize what the ending, you know, I had no clue until I read that that's what it was supposed to be like. And writing craft is more than just rules, but there are some. For an example, don't use any adverbs, vary your syntax, eliminate the use of was and had, that, so, well, even, just, and really. show, don't tell. And that's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
That's where a lot of people make a mistake. You show, don't tell. Limit your similes. And that's just a handful of what you could do. For an example, deep editing. I ran into deep editing after I'd already done the book, so I had to go back
and make sure
that everything was that way. Yeah.
Right.
In other words, use conflict. The details are very important. The close, the identify the audience, you play to the reader's emotions, and the relationship difficulties, alone time, the intellectual end of it, and the underdog. And what's important to the reader. So if your audience are animal lovers and it's an animal book, you play to animal lovers, okay? Uh-huh. Every character wants something. Why can't they get it? Identify the theme. What truths? And be bold about that. The difficulty of the times and the place. That's a biggie. Layer the conflict. And there always has to be conflict. And that's one thing that aggravated me, that I wanted to write a book without conflict. But you can't. Nobody will read it.
Right. I mean, there has to be energy, I think, is where the conflict is.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have energy moving you forward, you're not going to turn the pages to see what happens next.
That's true. That's true. And reduce the amount of author intrusion. It slows the story down. In other words, use as much dialogue as possible. And you must have a continual conflict throughout the book to the end, which automatically makes the ending and satisfies the reader.
Right.
And
right.
I managed that in this.
Right. Right. Very, very, very true. Well, having somebody that knows how to market, if you are self-publishing, so I know you can just use a template if you understand computers and you can put your book out there on Amazon. They have to accept it, but nevertheless, you can do it that way. The small publisher, like you say, the traditional route is mostly today, if you go into Barnes & Noble, you find that there is just tons of books in there, obviously.
Yeah.
But how do you get your book into Barnes & Noble? That's kind of a different story.
But getting it bought.
Yeah.
That's the biggie.
Right.
Here's a few more examples here. You got to make a checklist of details, okay? Mm-hmm. And then use that checklist throughout the book, for you got to do details. Mm-hmm. And include vivid contrasts. Brainstorm convincing names. My name, the villain, one of the villains in my book was named after a friend of mine, but it's the right name.
Oh, so you can't use that.
No, so I did. I used it and because I have a following in my old high school,
mm-hmm.
and they're buying the book. Most of them have already bought it, and they'll recognize the name.
So they'll know who this is.
But also, avoid only large-scale detail. In other words, don't only show broader social history, historical forces, but what do people eat and what do they wear? Show through the senses. Unveil your world through their characters' eyes, ears, and noses. And use detail. Learn from others. Make a vital plot. Study the plot. Okay,
mm-hmm.
The plot is so important, and you may have a plot within a plot too,
mm-hmm.
and as each of my chapters actually do,
mm-hmm.
and use symbolism and invoke the senses. Like I said, see, smell, hear, taste, feel. That all makes it real to people.
Right, I think that you did an excellent job in your book with that, because even when they were cooking, or when they were, you know, kind of slogging through the swampland, or, you know, something was happening, you brought in the sound, the smell, the taste, you know, where you could,
mm-hmm.
but certainly the visual and what you heard. So the more you use the senses, the more the reader is there.
Right.
And that's where a lot of authors that write this kind of book, it doesn't work, because if you haven't done that very well, then they're just reading words.
Right.
But they're not transported into the story.
The idea is, as one of my critics said, or my people that read the book said,
mm-hmm.
it was like a movie to me, Jim.
Uh-huh.
And another lady said, I couldn't keep turning the pages. I couldn't put it down.
So I felt real good about that, because that's what every writer wants.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, this hour went very, very quickly. I was going to have you read another passage, but we are literally out of time.
They'll just have to get the book, I guess.
They will. They're going to have to go again to your website.
It's jimleeauthor.com. JimLeeAuthor.com.
All right. So they'll find the book there. I certainly encourage people to go buy a copy of it. You will love hearing the story of old Florida through the eyes of a current day resident, but it'll make you feel like you've gone back in history and that you're reliving the history of Florida as it once was. So thank you so much, Jim, for joining me today.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I hope everybody goes out there and truly makes this your best life. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.